Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, we talk about the new Ryzen 3 processor release, Threadripper's impressive CPU box, and we take our first look at a Max-Q gaming notebook. It's all coming up and more.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 425, recorded on July 27th, 2017. Ryzen 3 and Threadripper's package. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Tracker, a coin-sized tracking device that pairs with your smartphone and keeps you from losing your most valued possessions. Visit thetracker.com right now and enter promo code TWITCH to save 20% off any order. Hey, everybody. Welcome to This Week in Computer Hardware. I am Ryan Shrout. Patrick Norton is out gallivanting through the woods in Yosemite, I believe. So joining me instead, locally but not remotely, is Alan Malventano.
Hi.
Hi, Alan. Thanks for coming back to the same table that we were at merely hours ago, recording a different show. But now we're going to do This Week in Computer Hardware. This is the show on the Twit Network that we talk about PC hardware, mobile phone hardware, notebooks, anything that is electronics-based we will touch on. Sometimes watches, GPS, speakers, all that stuff is kind of covered here. Although we do have a very like PC hardware-centric episode to really get into today.
Yep.
I want to start with something that just launched this morning. And that is, this is an empty box, but this is the box for what it is. This is the Ryzen 3 processor. This is AMD's, I was trying to write this in the review or not. It's their final release of the Ryzen mainstream platform, right? Yeah. So when they announced Ryzen, they talked about Ryzen 7, Ryzen 5, and Ryzen 3. Mm-hmm. And that it was going to compete in, against the Core i7, the Core i5, and the Core i3. This is the final of those three steps.
Yep, the fewest number of cores.
The same number of cores.
Oh.
As the Ryzen 5 parts. Well, some of the Ryzen 5 parts. Ryzen 5 had a 6-core and 2 quad cores. So but they had SMT enabled.
Oh.
These processors are quad core, no SMT, so just quad core 4-thread.
Okay.
They are the Ryzen 3 1300X and the Ryzen 3 1200. They have clock speeds a little bit lower than what we've seen in the other processors as well. Looks like the 1300X goes up to 3.7 gigahertz with a base of 3.4, while the Ryzen 3 1200 has a base of 3.1 and goes up to 3.4. So there's a 300 megahertz gap between these two parts.
Okay.
They both have 8 megs of cache. They both have DDR4 2400 memory support. They're both labeled as 65-watt TDP. But they are significantly lower cost than the other Ryzen parts we've seen. The 1300X is $129, and the Ryzen 3 1200 is $109. And as you look at that kind of lineup that's on the screen now, that kind of compares the Core i3, Core i5, and even Ryzen 5 lineup, you see that it's kind of an interesting mix. We see this a lot in the really low-priced GPU market as well, where it gets very complex because $10 either way is going to change which processor you're going to select.
Yeah.
So the 1300X at $129 is slightly more expensive than the Core i3 7100, but slightly less expensive than the Core i3 7350K. Mm. Right. And then the Ryzen 3 1200 is, is between the Core i3 7100 and the Pentium G4560, still Kaby Lake. Although the Kaby Lake Pentium is actually has an MSRP of $65, but you haven't been able to find it for that for a while. It's hard to get a hold of. What's interesting to note about these comparisons is that the Core i3 parts and the Pentium are dual core hyper-threaded.
Yep.
Right. So they're 2-core 4-threads going up against quad core, like true core, all 4 threads designs.
Yep. One thread per core.
If you look at the core or the Ryzen 5, you have 6-core and 4-core to 8-thread, and then so we assume Ryzen 5 is going to be faster in all the multi-threaded applications. The interesting comparison I was looking into is like those Core i5s in the end are quad-core 4-thread as well. So they kind of have the same core count and division as the Ryzen 3s, but they are priced significantly higher, $200, $240. So it's a very different, you're talking about 100%, 80% difference in price. So
yeah.
Worth noting that as people kind of look through the benchmarks. The platforms are the same here. You're looking at the same AM4 socket. support for the same chipsets. Technically it can support the X370, but you probably shouldn't be using it because that's an expensive motherboard for a very cheap processor. B350, A320 is where you want to go. And the only difference is the A320 does not support CPU overclocking, whereas the B350 does. Both of those still support memory overclocking, which is more important for the Ryzen platform than for the Intel platform. If you go back up, that cooler is also worth pointing out. We have one of them here. This is the Wraith Spire, I want to say. Yeah, Ken confirms for me. This doesn't have LED lights. It doesn't have any of the fancy stuff, but it's a nice cooler that does a fantastic job of running quietly while keeping the CPU cool.
Well, and it's all aluminum.
Yeah.
Like with no copper core in the middle.
Correct. Hmm. But it's included with the processor. So it's in box with the retail packaging. So for $129 or even $109, you get the processor and you get a cooler. It's just one of the things you don't have to worry about.
Yeah, it saves you a few bucks.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's just less hassle, right? We mentioned the platforms. The core-to-core latency, kind of, that's more of a super technical thing, but it remains the same. It's interesting because in our previous looks at that, we've always had SMT to contend with. Mm-hmm. So two threads running on the same core were equal latency, right? Like those two threads communicated pretty much instantaneously. When you don't have SMT, first of all, there's way less data points on the graph because there's only four logical cores to really look at. But the performance results kind of look the same. As we cross between the CCXs on the same die, that latency goes up to somewhere around 130, 135 nanoseconds. Whereas if you're on the same core, if you're on the same CCX, the core-to-core communication is around 40, 43.
Yeah, so it's like a three times jump.
Yeah. But that's very similar to what we saw in Ryzen 5 and Ryzen 7 because all of these parts are single die. It's just how many cores per CCX are they enabling or disabling, essentially. Performance-wise, this was an interesting comparison. It should surprise nobody that the single-threaded performance leader is the Intel product line. The Core i3 and the Pentium both actually run at higher clock speeds than the Ryzen 3 while also having better IPC.
Yep.
So if you look at tests like the Cinebench single threaded, or you look at, you know, here, the Audacity MP3 encode, where lower is better, make sure you keep that in mind as you look at these metrics. And this is a very single threaded application. The Ryzen 3 struggles to keep up with anything, and so does the Ryzen 5. The Ryzen 5 is actually slower than the Core i3 and Core i5 parts in those tests as well. And you see that kind of duplicated across anything that is heavily single-threaded. But when you get into multi-threaded workloads, you start to see the benefit that Ryzen 3 has over Core i3. So if you look at, there's Cinebench single-thread. If you scroll down to Cinebench multi-thread right there, you get a little bit of an idea of what the differences are. So even though the Core i3 addresses four threads, SMT / hyper-threading is less effective. You're sharing resources across two threads, whereas in the Ryzen 3 true quad-core, you're not. Mm-hmm. Those resources are all independent, so you're going to get a pretty significant performance boost. Now, as you scroll down there and you look at something like the Ryzen 5 1600X, it stands out a lot because it is a 6-core 12-thread, significantly faster across that. Pavre, another good example of that. If you look at some, and, you know, we have to look through all these, but if you look at like Sysmark and that type of stuff, it's very responsiveness-based. So the ability for the Core i3 processors to take advantage of speed shift and boost up very quickly gives it an advantage in that regard. Gaming performance is interesting to see. As the gaming performance at 1080p has been the sore spot for Ryzen since the Ryzen 7 release. It progressed through Ryzen 5. It kind of remained the same.
Yep.
The interesting thing with the Ryzen 3 versus Core i3 is that we're getting down to the number of cores and threads where like a dual core part is going to struggle with some gaming.
Yeah, right? Because you have like four solid threads worth of things going on, and you're trying to squeeze all that into two cores.
Yeah, four threads in a game engine is very common now.
Yep.
Whereas, you know, having 8 or 16 is uncommon. So, but when you start to see that, what you'll notice is that if you look at Ryzen 5 versus Core i5, the Core i5 probably had an advantage in most of the time. But in Core i3 versus Ryzen 3, it's much closer together. In general, I'd say the Core i3 and the Pentium are doing a little bit better on average, but it's much closer than anything we had seen before, right? If you look at something like Far Cry Primal, the Ryzen 3 parts are, you know, basically in line with the Core i3 7100 and the Pentium G 4560. But if you look at the Ryzen 5 compared to the Core i5, it's actually a little bit slower, right? So it's a difference of, we're getting down into the segment of parts where core and thread count actually have a direct impact on games, regardless of the IPC and clock speed. So it's worth taking note of. And what I think this means is, for people who are interested in buying this processor for like a budget gaming build, there are way fewer caveats of "yeah, but" that than existed with Ryzen 5 or Ryzen 7, mm-hmm. right? So if you know you're spending $120 on a CPU at the most, then the Ryzen 3 1200 is going to do just as good at gaming, more or less, than the Core i3 7100 or the Pentium G 4560. And that's actually impressive, because the G 4560 runs at 4.2 gigahertz all the time. Like, there's no turbo boost. It'll clock down to save power, but it's not right. Like there's no turbo states in it. And normally that G 4560 has been that target budget gaming processor, and, you know, used for a lot of other purposes. Power consumption is the last thing I'll mention. Ryzen 3 uses more power than Core i3, especially the 1300X. This is some of the stuff that confuses me about some of these launches that AMD's had, is the 1300X and 1200 are both rated at 65 watts. This is total system power draw, so don't look at these numbers so much as the difference between them.
Right.
There's a full 20-watt difference, 20-watt plus difference between power consumed by the Ryzen 1300X and by the Ryzen 3 1200. You're running at 300 megahertz higher clocks is the difference here. Sure. So
it's weird that they both have the same rating then.
Yeah, I would agree. Like, I don't know. I've had a partial discussion with AMD about that, like where their TDP versus
reality.
Well, their argument is that TDP doesn't measure power draw; it measures thermal dissipation. So as long as things clock down at a certain time, that, you know, they can still have a 65-watt cooler and it would still be effective. And
I guess
it is. But what they're essentially kind of getting into is SDP, which is what Intel created. That
right.
Goes like scenario design power. TDP is just has had a very specific definition for a long time, and I wish they would adhere to it. Performance per dollar graphs are in there. I think you can pretty much surmise what that comes from and what that equates to after looking at the results. You know, in the single-threaded tests, it's not going to be great. Audacity, Cinebench single thread, that's not great. But as you get into the multi-threaded and into the gaming, the performance per dollar is really, really good. It's better than the Core i3. It's better than the Core i5 in a lot of cases, in actually every case, and better than the Ryzen 5 in some cases too. The Pentium G 4560 is an interesting data point in there, because it's so cheap, it's $80. And if we could actually had found it for the $65 MSRP that it had, it would be even more impressive in that performance per dollar. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know if it went on sale yet today. The Ryzen 3 did it. Okay, so it's actually available for sale. And the B350 and A320 motherboards have been out for a while, so you can pick those up. So if you are looking for a budget build and all these performance numbers and stuff really make sense to you, give it a look. It's good. We'll talk about it in a little bit, the AMD earnings. This is, you know, the Ryzen 3 is probably the biggest part of the market, more on the OEM side than on the retail side. So we'll have to see what impact this actually has, if Dells and HPs and those guys that are selling business machines into work environments start to integrate Ryzen 3 at the same level they do Core i3, or if that will need to be the Ryzen Pro that does that. So that's the Ryzen 3. We'll move that box off to the side. We also took a look at, you know, on the extreme far end of the scale. We talked about $109 processor. Mm-hmm. We talked about a $2,799 notebook.
That's pretty thin notebook.
It is. So I think we talked about on the show with Patrick when NVIDIA announced the Max-Q design idea. It was essentially to bring gaming notebooks into a thinner, lighter, quieter working environment so that you didn't have to have big, bulky hardware in order to get pretty good gaming performance. We have the machine here. And as I hold it, it's, first of all, it's still a big laptop, especially if you look at it this way. It's a 15.5 inch, 15.6 inch screen, It's widescreen, it's big, but in terms of like thinness, it's
pretty thin.
It's pretty impressive, right? Yeah. It's hard for me to get this profile exactly right.
Like a couple iPhones thick.
Yeah. Yeah, and I actually have it sit next to the Surface Pro 4 or Surface Pro 5 / Surface Pro 2017. What the hell am I saying?
It's similar. It's a little thicker.
Is really close.
Yeah.
It's a much bigger device in total, but it's pretty close. So the Zephyrus has a couple of unique traits. The keyboard and trackpad stand out in that they are moved forward on the device. Did you get a chance to type on it all or
no,
use it at all? The idea of having the keyboard... Like there's basically no wrist rest on the device itself. And the trackpad is moved, instead of where your thumbs are, over to the right-hand side. The
keyboard's nice.
The key travel is good. Like yeah. The key feel is fantastic. The touchpad actually works well. It's an odd aspect ratio because it's taller than wider.
Yeah.
So it takes some getting used to. It does remove palm rejection. You don't have to worry about that on this laptop.
You're not
that's
be
for
resting
sure.
Your palm right
they do
there.
Include, you can see in that picture, that's just a rubber wrist rest, essentially, that they ship with the machine that sits in front of the notebook.
So it doesn't attach.
Yeah.
Just kind of sits on the desk in front of it.
Yep. And it does help a tremendous amount. But, sure. You know, that's something they had to do because of the comfort level of using it. Now, the flagship feature of this or design feature is what you're looking at here. It's only, I want to say, what is it, Ken? It is 0.67 inches thick. It's 17 millimeters thick when it's closed, but it's 17.78 millimeters when it's open. Is that right? Or no, I don't think that's actually measured. What you're looking at here is, the video shows it better, but I don't know where the timestamp is. When it's open, there's a mechanic in the screen that actually... separates the bottommost layer of the laptop from the rest of the laptop, creating a space behind it or underneath it for airflow to come into the fans and cool the products.
Huh.
And it does this to...
It's like a door that opens.
Yeah, it kind of is. It's hard to see, and we won't be able to show it on this... on the live stream through the Skype video, but I would encourage you to go to the review and check out the video we did of it. There's a couple of very good animations or video clips we did showing that behavior.
And there's actually a gap, like you can just see right
like
through.
How big is that gap, you think?
Like, I don't know, 4 millimeters or so?
Yeah.
Something like that?
The point of it is to allow airflow into the fans that cool the CPU and the GPU.
Well, that'll totally do it.
Allowing the fans to run slower so they can be quieter, but also more efficient, keeping the GPU cooler and in its most efficient area, right? Like its most efficient point of its performance per watt curve, right? It's a really interesting design because it makes perfect sense if you think about it, right? Why not make it even go up further? Because you close it, you put it in your bag, you don't really care.
Right.
It's when you open it and you're actually using it in gaming that it matters. You know, how hot things are getting and how much airflow the machine gets.
I think if they open it much further, then you risk like stuff getting stuck in there and, you know.
That's true.
Like now it gets to the point where stuff can actually.
A bunch of cat hair getting in there at that point. Right?
Yeah.
Crumbs.
Cat hair gets everywhere regardless. Blades. Like there's no way around that.
Specification wise, it's Core i7 7700 HQ CPU. That's a quad core with hyper threading. It's got the GTX 1080 with Max-Q design is the actual name of the GTX 1080.
So actual quad core in a mobile part. Yeah. Is like
it's a 35
odd thing, right?
That's kind of unusual. It's still like for Kaby Lake, it's unusual.
Yeah.
But it is a 35 watt TDP part. Yeah, you can see here. Here's that animation. This is from the back of the device. And as the monitor opens up, you'll see the Zephyrus name there kind of raise up as the hinge movement moves on. So it's a neat design, and it's something I think I would like to see included on more notebooks, even if they're not like Max-Q design or whatever for like gaming machines that want to get more airflow. Other hardware specs, 24 gigs of memory. It is a 120 hertz G-Sync panel, 1080p, 512 gig NVMe SSD, 802.11ac, Thunderbolt 3, HDMI 2, USB 3. It's got a 50 watt hour battery, but the battery life sucks, as you would expect. It's $2,700. So it's expensive for sure. But Ken did some research on this and found that it was among the cheapest gaming notebooks you could buy with a GTX 1080 in it. So while it is expensive, relative to the market as a whole, it is not that expensive relative to the high-end gaming notebook market specifically. Performance of the GPU is somewhere in the realm of a desktop GTX 1070, a little bit higher than that, somewhere between a 1070 and a 1080. Ironically, kind of putting it in the realm of the RX Vega, now that I think about it, or the Vega GPU in general, based on our first testing. But this is all done at 1080p, and ideally what we'd want to do is we would want to compare this to other GTX 1080 laptops, but we don't get to keep the gaming laptop, so it's more difficult for us to do those comparisons long term when drivers and games and stuff update all the time. The expected performance from NVIDIA on this is around 90% of a mobile GTX 1080, and that's probably in line with where we ended up. So you can see we did Dirt Rally and Hitman and GTA 5 and a handful of other games in the performance testing. We did testing to make sure that the thermal throttling didn't affect anything. Performance running at just starting a game for the first time versus performance running at 45 to an hour into the gaming session was basically identical. So CPU and storage performance were great. This is essentially a 960 Pro class SSD, right?
Yeah, just like an OEM version of it.
Yeah. CPU performance, because it's a quad core hyper-threaded, Kaby Lake high core or high clock speed is probably the fastest CPU in a notebook we've ever tested. So if you wanted to buy this machine for gaming, but also, I don't want to say like productivity tasks, but if you're doing like video editing, photo editing, those types of things, it's actually going to be really, really, really good at that as well relative to the rest of the notebook market. But you do pay for it with battery life. Our Wi-Fi battery test got us 1.95 hours, but which by my math is under 2 hours. So there's that. Comparing that to something even like the Dell Inspiron 15 Gaming that had a Core i5 processor, and would that have a 1060 in it, I think? That had 7.7 hours of battery life. Yeah. So there's a big difference there. The difference is that the GTX 1080 with Max-Q design is in its full always-on state. Because it's a G-Sync panel, you can't use Optimus type technologies to like pass it through the Intel integrated graphics and thus, disable the GPU when it's not in gaming mode. So that's your sacrifice for thinness, gaming performance, quiet integration, all that type of stuff.
And that alone is probably not the whole reason for the reduction in battery life. But, I mean, obviously it contributes. But
you got the quad core processor.
Yeah.
You've got 24 gigs of memory.
Yeah.
It's two DIMMs plus soldered on, so there's
is the battery itself like
it's not 50 that... watt hour. I mean, it's a sizable battery. It's like the size you would get in a Dell XPS 13 or so.
But it is a pretty big screen.
Big screen, yeah, 120 hertz, so it's frequently refreshing. Yeah. There's other things that go into it, but it's the net result is not great. Overall, I think the notebook is pretty good. The usability is questionable. You should read Ken's article for his views on using this on your lap is not really workable because you have to put it so far back on your knees to access the keyboard that it feels like it's just going to fall over at any time. So keep that in mind. I'll be curious to see what other Max-Q implementations come out from MSI or Clevo, whoever else is going to do them. But I am a fan of this. And we used this for a game stream recently, and it was quiet enough that we could use lav mics while this was on the desk, and it didn't really impact things. So a really well-engineered product. Zephyrus, odd name. And then real quick before we get to our break, the kind of on the other side of the notebook realm, I did an iPad Pro versus Surface Pro comparison, both of the 2017 models. So the Kaby Lake Core i5 Surface Pro versus the new Apple A10X iPad Pro, both in the 10.5 and 12.9-inch screen configurations. This is something I really encourage everybody to read because there's some benchmarks in here, but the real premise of the story is what is my view of using either of these devices as productivity? And you have an iPad Pro. You have the smaller, the 9.7.
Yep.
And so you agree with me, like the typing on these keyboards is actually surprisingly good.
It is.
Surprisingly good.
Yeah.
And actually, I would say the same for the Surface Pro itself with its keyboard. It's surprisingly good for a fold-out tablet attached keyboard. The 12.9 inch iPad Pro feels too big. It's
It
feels oversized and overweighted for the keyboard and for the size of the like cover that you can get with it.
Yeah, it's too top heavy.
Yeah,
like for how far back the cover, like the kickstand-ish right. kind of thing on the cover, you know, because it makes a triangle mm-hmm. in the back of it, and it just doesn't go far enough. For right. the, like for the, just the size and weight of, you know, it does scale up proportionally, but when you have such a larger thing. You know, any tilt backwards at all.
Yeah.
Like it's just going to go.
And
the
even
rest
like
of the way.
Typing on it, it felt like I had to, it almost felt like I had to keep my hands on the keyboard to keep just it from tilting it. Back. Yeah. Right. Which was obviously not ideal. The Surface Pro didn't have any of those problems. The kickstand integrated into the Surface Pro tablet itself is far and away a better implementation for this type of product. Yeah. And it works out really well.
Especially if you're not using the keyboard / cover.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Because you just have a built-in thing that just props it up for you.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about, you know, a regular iPad without any kind of cover. Like, you're just holding it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the only way to do it. Or you're trying to find something to prop it up on.
I hope you just, like, look straight down at the table.
Yeah.
To watch your video.
Which is great.
You know, the pens work really well for both of these systems. The screens are both phenomenal, or all phenomenal, even though the iPad Pro does get the edge with its 120 hertz display and DCI P3 color space. The battery life is substantially better on the iPad Pro. It really comes down to the operating system and the applications, though, because both of these configurations or all these systems perform pretty well. If we just say, can you type Word documents on them? Yes. Can you browse the internet? Can you answer email? Can you do the typical things you would do on a tablet convertible for productivity? And you absolutely can. The difference is iOS 10, which is what this testing was done on. We'll try it again when iOS 11 actually comes out. iOS 10 is just not built for productivity and creation in that way. Like the multitasking is very limited. It's slower to do so. Windows is just built for that. And that you see that, like if you look at SysMark or WebExpert, like those show the performance of the Intel Core i5, like single threaded capabilities, CPU bound capabilities. And then you couple that with like Windows is just built for that environment.
Yeah.
Right. Surprisingly, the graphics on the iPad Pro, the graphics portion of the SoC is actually way better.
Yep.
Than the Core i5 graphics.
Yeah, more powerful than the built-in.
Now, the benefit of that, I think, is debatable. Because
that's true, with how much you're going to actually do on either of these devices, right?
Like, on a Surface Pro, you're probably not gaming. Right. Maybe you would if the GPU was better. You know, that's a fair argument to have. But if you're buying these devices as a productivity thing, chances are the graphics performance isn't that necessary. And if you do happen to buy an iPad Pro, the gaming capability is there. It's the best gaming processor that Apple makes for iOS. And so you could utilize all those games.
There's definitely an ecosystem. It's a different ecosystem, but
it's way more crowded, but it is way more, I don't want to say it's way more developed because it's Windows. Like Windows basically has everything on it. You can get Steam, you can get GOG, you can get all that. But the ease of access to games, I guess I would say, is easier on the iOS system. So, take a look at that story if you've been considering buying an iPad Pro to replace a laptop, or maybe even if you've been looking at the Surface Pro to replace your current laptop. I think you'll get some interesting feedback from my experiences using that over several weeks with each of those devices. So, if I had to pick one, I definitely like the 10.5-inch iPad Pro the best.
Yeah,
it's the correct ratio of size to weight to performance to screen, all that good stuff.
And it's not much bigger than the 9.7.
No.
Like the older one.
No, because it's got a little bit smaller bezel.
Yep.
So actually the physical size may be very, very close. But in terms of like, hey, you actually need to get stuff done every once in a while, it's still really difficult to depend on the iPad Pro consistently. Like for me, one of these things that you just never think about until you try to do it is editing in our website's back end with uploading images, the process with which to upload images just doesn't really work through Safari or Chrome on iOS.
Yeah, right? It's really just cumbersome.
Yeah.
Like,
and that's kind of like a vast majority of my workflow is putting things on a website.
Yeah.
So there you go. All right, we're going to take a break right here and thank today's podcast sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Tracker. There's a ritual to looking for your keys. if you don't hang them up, if you're not organized, if maybe she's not listening, so I'll say maybe you're like my wife and they just kind of go into a diaper bag, to a purse, to a counter, to whatever.
The freezer.
First, you check the obvious places like the couch, the kitchen, pockets. If you have a kid, this is way more complex.
Oh, yeah.
Because if they get a hold of those keys, you never know. Like, they're going to be in the toy refrigerator in the ice maker.
Yep.
Right? That seems like the place that it would go. Mm-hmm. Then you start getting creative. You're looking at, you know, peanut butter jar. Kelly has found keys in the refrigerator, the actual refrigerator before. Because she had keys in a, you know, like a 12-pack or something in both hands, put them down and kind of shut the door and moved on. 8 years ago, Tracker changed everything when they released their first tracking device. And now they've done it again with the all-new Tracker Pixel. With the Pixel, you never worry about losing your things again. It's the lightest Bluetooth tracking device on the market. You can place the Tracker Pixel on whatever you tend to lose, your keys, your wallet, your cat, I guess. When you misplace an item that has a Tracker Pixel attached, you use your smartphone and a 90 decibel alert will help you find it in seconds. It even has powerful LED lights so you can find it in the dark. If you lose your phone, just press the button on your Tracker Pixel and your phone rings, even if it's on silent. So it will work in the reverse way as well. You can even locate your item if it's miles away, because every Tracker user is part of the largest crowd locate network in the world. And Tracker's 30-day money-back guarantee means you'll have truly nothing to lose. Go to thetracker.com, that's thetracker.com, and enter promo code TWITCH to save 20% off any order. That's thetracker.com, promo code TWITCH for 20% off, and we thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Now, I feel like we've been talking about a lot of AMD stuff for basically like the last 5 months.
We have.
There's a couple of new things that AMD came out with this week. A new driver release, not a whole lot to talk about here, not a big performance boost increase. They've added a couple of features like the Crimson Relive capability, which is their capture streaming integrated into the driver piece of software. Mm-hmm. Get some improvements to, you can now record at 100 megabits per second as opposed to 50 megabits per second. You can adjust microphone settings. You can set camera transparencies, things like that. User improvements in that way. Radeon Chill, which is their proprietary technology to lower average power consumption of your GPU based on the activity of the game you're playing. So if you're standing still, it understands it can lower the frame rate and lower the power consumed by the GPU. And then as soon as you start to move, the instant you start to move, it picks up the frame rate so that you're not losing any interactivity. That is expanded out to 30 plus games now and a lot of very modern games and different APIs. Frame rate target control, per display color controls, a lot of features added this time around. The most interesting one is something called Enhanced Sync, which is an attempt to create a tech that solves the problems of VSync without implementing the latency induction of mouse having VSync on, right? So say you have a 60 hertz monitor, but your game can render at 90. If you leave VSync on, you get the visual improvement of no tearing on your screen. But you are pushing back to the game engine that, hey, I only need you to check on my inputs once every 60 or once every 11.
Basically, you kind of stack up like an extra frame and like buffered sort of, right? So the end result is you end up with extra input lag.
Right.
As you know, as the game goes high, you know, faster than 60 hertz, you know, as it does, because the game engine is going to vary, right? Mm-hmm. But as every time you get a rise in frame rate, like rendering ability higher than 60, then you'll get this, you know.
Well, with VSync on, and for many games, it just never goes above 60. The render rate gets capped by the pushback of the driver itself.
Right, right. I'm talking like the engine speed. Like it could have gone higher.
It could go faster. Correct.
Yeah.
And so what Enhanced Sync does is it basically decouples the frame display from the frame rendering portion of the pipe.
Yep.
And if you're running on a 60 hertz display and the game is running at 90, the driver tells the game engine, keep going. Go as fast as you can.
Yeah.
And then what it does is when the monitor says, again, with no tearing on the screen, I'm ready for the beginning of the next frame.
Yep.
It just basically takes the most recently completed frame, mm-hmm. complete frame, and displays it. So The result is you get no screen tearing, but you get lower input latency that is very close to that of a VSync off situation.
Yep.
Right. NVIDIA's had this since the GTX 10 series launch. They call it Fast Sync. Same idea here. Although the AMD version does implement something on the bottom side, which is much more complex and kind of more dives into the pattern recognition of when you're going to drop into these kind of what do you call it? What's the term I'm thinking of? I can't think of where you quantization.
Yeah.
Where you, when you're on a 60 hertz panel, when you drop below a certain amount, you have no choice but to go to 45 frames per second effective, and then 30, and then 20, yep. Right? And as the, if you go between those jumps often enough, or even not even really often, just at all, it appears to be judder and stutter, right? So that's obviously a negative. Enhanced Sync will improve that a little bit by trying to determine the best times to display full frames versus displaying torn frames in order to reduce stutter, but also minimize frame tears as well. So that's probably the most important feature that they've added in this iteration. There's some other things like a GPU profiler and whatever, more centered at developers. But good to see AMD keeping up the iteration on software releases. But maybe the most exciting AMD news of the week was Threadripper's package.
Just a box? It's exciting?
Yes.
It's not even a box. It's not box shaped.
It's more like old school tube TV shaped.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This is just basically something that AMD's social team teased out on social media, Twitter and whatnot, showing CEO Lisa Su holding a Threadripper box. And what's important about this is that it is not a cardboard square angled box that just happens to have the Threadripper logo on the side. It's like styrofoam. There's a paper wrap around it. If you go up to the previous picture, you can see there's like an Eye of Sauron / space field around it. And if you look right behind the Z, you can actually see the top of the Threadripper CPU itself.
Like the CPU is just sitting in there.
It's like it's magically floating in the back. And so, of course,
watching everybody.
Yeah, it does. It very much looks like an eye staring at you. So I imagine this, look, it's just a box. It doesn't tell you anything about the performance. What it does tell you is kind of AMD is taking great care with this product launch, with this Threadripper CPU, right? They're not just kind of phoning it in.
Not in a brown box.
Right, right. You know, they're proud of it, right? And they're willing to spend the money on packaging like this for a $999 or $799 CPU, which makes a reasonable amount of sense. I guess there's nothing else really we can say about that, but we're getting pretty close. This weekend I'll be in LA at SIGGRAPH, that Eye of Sauron. Where AMD is going to unveil Threadripper to some other capacity and RX Vega at their Capsaicin event. So it'll be exciting to see what they come up with there. And they've already said that early August is when Threadripper would actually go on sale and be available for purchase. So I'm excited about it. I think it's going to be a pretty good part, and it will create some competition and excitement in that HEDT market that we haven't seen. But I imagine, like, if you buy one of these, like, that's going to go on a shelf. That's going to be in a prominent location. If you're as big of a nerd to buy a $1,000 CPU,
yeah,
then this is going to be a cool keepsake. Much better than this box, right? Which is just it's a well-designed cardboard box, but
it's just a box.
It's still just a cardboard box,
yeah,
right? And the same thing goes for all of Intel's parts. They are just cardboard boxes and way less substantial than even that. So worth noting.
Yep.
There is we don't have a review of this yet, but we'll have one soon. This is the Toshiba XG5 SSD.
Yes. So
that it apparently performs pretty well, but nobody can buy it.
It's an OEM SSD.
Okay.
So typically Toshiba's product lines are OEM parts. Like, that's what their SSD lines have been just historically. And then they acquired OCZ, and OCZ now is sort of their retail arm.
Right.
Right. So things with the OCZ branding to them, OCZ is basically just like the retail brand of Toshiba now. We expect that this new SSD, which is called the XG5, there should be a retail version of it at some point,
okay,
right? But for the moment, this is a thing that could potentially be in laptops that you buy.
Yeah.
Right. And laptops with OEM SSDs, like, it's getting better, but historically it's been like, oh, it's an OEM SSD. You know, usually it's just some really poor performing thing. And
right.
Sometimes it's even, you know, more stuttery than a hard disk would have been in some cases.
Okay, like, that's bad.
That's bad, right?
Yeah.
OCZ, well, sorry, not OCZ, Toshiba actually sampled these out to a few review sites, the XG5. And we did some tests. We haven't published our review yet, but which site was this? Was it Tech Report? Yeah. Tech Report has their review up, and they're showing it running, kind of nipping at the heels of a 960 Evo and 960 Pro from Samsung, which are the SSDs that, you know, usually just kind of slaughter everything else. So to have anything come close,
that's good,
is significant, right? And Toshiba, including OCZ, absolutely needed this because previous SSDs from them will typically have, you know, odd kind of issues here and there, just like weird latency issues and consistency issues. And
yes,
you know, there's been a lot of that in the past. So they really needed a good solid SSD launch where, you know, the controller is good. There's no kind of hiccups. There's no weird stuff going on. The flash is quick. This flash, it does look to be actually very quick, even though it's TLC. It has an SLC cache on it, but still, it's, you know, at some point it has to write to the TLC, right? Mm-hmm. It's actually their new 64-layer flash, so it's 3D style flash memory, right? But yeah, it's just good to see, you know, what looks like a really strong performing SSD out of them. The big question mark though is we can't really be comparing prices. Like, is it much cheaper than a 960 or more expensive? Like, it's OEM right now,
right?
So
right.
We don't have retail pricing. We don't even know where it falls. But if it's priced anywhere near it, like the Samsung counterparts, you know, pretty good. It's good competition, right? This is the kind of thing you would need to come out for drives like the 960 Pro to actually start coming down in price.
Which they haven't really done.
Exactly. Yeah. They've been like 70 cents, 60, 70 cents a gig for those since they launched. And it really hasn't changed.
Yeah.
The Evo is cheaper, but still, like, it's still on the higher end because it's a, you know, they can afford to do it because it's higher performing by a fairly large margin compared to other stuff. So we need some other SSDs to compete with those. And this looks to be one of them. Again, it's not matching its performance, but it's close enough to be like, you know, if this drive was, say, 10 or 20% cheaper, then it would just be, it would just be kind of like a no-brainer. You might as well just go with that one.
And even though I haven't published our review, you haven't seen any like kind of performance anomalies
We ran it through our whole suite, which is partially tuned to pick up on those kinds of anomalies because of prior OCZ SSDs.
Right.
And it passed, you know, all those gates. It passed. Nothing looked weird. Performance looked good. Yeah. Yeah. So it looks good. Mm-hmm. We just need a retail version of it. And actually, part of the reason that I didn't rush to put out our review was because, well, it's an OEM part. Like, you can't buy it. So,
I mean, clearly the reason that Toshiba/OCZ would send us this drive is because they want to, a couple of reasons. One is they want to make the case to these OEMs, hey, true, look, all these reviewers love our product. You put it in your system.
Yes.
You get that automatic benefit right there.
Yeah.
And it might also be,
they wanted to showcase their flash.
Oh, okay.
Was the other, for the other new, part of it.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is also, it's the first product that has their 64 layer. It's a BICS, as you just call it, BICS. Is the yeah, type of their flash.
Yeah.
You know, like Samsung has VNAND.
Right.
Right. And this is kind of like their name for it.
For the other reason I would think you'd do that if I were a product manager is to maybe some upper executives aren't real keen on rushing this out to a retail delivery. You show, hey, look how good the OEM version looks on all these guys' tests. Yeah. They get greenlit for the retail box a little bit better. And I think that might be part of it too.
Yeah.
And thinking as a business guy in that regard.
And I would suspect a retail version of this would probably be almost an identical drive, just with an OCZ model name on it.
Just a different label,
instead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So one of the things, we'll move on to here to our last little bit here, is we always talk about high-end motherboards on X99, X299, even like Z270. It's been a long time since we've seen flagship quality products that mattered on the AMD side. So we just talked about the Ryzen 3 and how important Ryzen 5 and Ryzen 7 were. I was uncharacteristically giddy to post, to update an ad creative from Gigabyte on our site today because they're publishing their first X399 ads on PC Per. And I'm just like, it's kind of getting me excited. Like, okay, this is actually happening. There's going to be all this new product out there. Asus did unveil the X370 ROG Crosshair 6 Extreme. This is an AMD AM4 motherboard that is basically on par feature-wise and price-wise with any of the top like Z270 motherboards on the market. It has 12-phase VRM power. It has tons of expansion and storage. You know, two M.2 slots, 8 SATA ports. One of the M.2 slots is under the passive PCH heatsink, which is something we've seen on another board recently. Connects directly to the CPU while the other M.2 slot goes through the PCI 2 lanes coming off the chipset. So there is a little bit of a difference there.
Yep.
It has a massive VRM heatsink that can be swapped out for a monoblock that can be integrated into a custom water cooling loop. And Asus is partnering with Bits Power for the monoblock that will be sold separately, not included in the box with it, because you know, the number of people that would use that is smaller than even the market that would buy a motherboard of this price.
Right.
I hope that their Asus Fan Expert 4 software has been updated accordingly.
because
this motherboard apparently has 13 fan headers on the PCB itself. And the picture is not the greatest resolution, but if you click on it and get the larger version or kind of just zoom in on it, like in the top right-hand corner, there's 6 in the bottom just below the chipset heatsink. You'll find, I think, 5 more.
Yeah.
And then there's a couple of other ones littered throughout. And they're all in places where you would want to have them. And they even have a fan extension card, apparently, that gives you 3 additional fan headers for a total of 16.
Nice round number for
16
fans.
I like one of the features. I like, you can see in that picture there. I was actually, if you bring it back up, the ATX connector is right angle.
The power connector.
Yeah, the ATX power connector is right angle.
Yeah. Right there by the dimmer.
Now the ones up top in the upper left hand corner, you can just barely see them. They are not at a right angle, but I think that's more because you won't be able to fit a lot of cases otherwise.
That's true.
But the idea of a right angle ATX connector is fantastic. There were probably some additional engineering that had to be done in order to maintain, you know.
Well, it looks like they have a plastic because usually you would have the pins would have to go.
Right angle.
They would have to make that angle.
Yeah, and I'm sure they are hidden behind that plastic cover.
Right. So they had to put a plastic cover over it. Otherwise, you'd have exposed pins with like 12 volts from your power supply. Well, if you drop something in there.
If you touch it.
I mean, you know.
Probably not.
I guess it's hazardous to drop your pocket change in any system, but like, you know, but this one would be even, you know, more likely to short something out.
Yeah. Yeah. You can see it's got 802.11 AC at least. So. It might have AD on it. No, I think just AC. USB 3.1 Gen 2. It has 5 gold plated 3.5mm audio jacks.
It's backlit.
Yes.
Like that's actual.
Yeah, the lights on the back there show that the RGB capability of the lights on the back of the motherboard, which I actually think is a cool idea. If you have a windowed case, as long as the case is built in a way so that
you can actually see the
lighting. It reflects enough of the light. I think probably you run into a lot of cases that are like a very deep matte black finish, which won't reflect the light very well.
That's true.
But, you know, you might be able to get creative and maybe just kind of like spray paint some silver stuff over it
You could just lay something back there like to reflect the light. Yeah,
You know, get some white foam board or something. Yeah, foam board would be too thick. Something like that. But, you know, you might have to do a little bit to make that. Obviously, it's more improved or looks way better in the photography that Asus provides, but this is cool. And this is kind of like the beginning of this.
Oh, and it has pretty high-end audio for a
I don't remember what it was. Josh was very impressed with it. An S122 codec paired with an ESS Saber DAC.
Yep.
And it uses op amps, TI op amps for 113 dB line in and 120 dB output.
Yeah.
It's an impressive board. They don't have a pricing for it yet. The Crosshair 6 Hero is like $270 with Wi-Fi, so you're probably going to pay at least $370, probably $399, maybe a little bit more than that for this product.
I think there's...
Which is a lot.
There might be actually a few more features on this guy compared to the previous one, so...
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the Crosshair 6 Hero is the same generation. It's just less features. That's the word we use for our original Ryzen 7 launch reviews and whatnot. So, and this is going to carry over to X399 for Threadripper. We've already, we've got our X399 motherboard in, and it's an impressive looking piece of product. Yeah. So I'm looking forward to more competition in that field and seeing AMD's processors get some love in that area. So I guess that's it. That's all the stories we have lined up for you. Next week we'll be here. I assume Patrick will be back. Who knows? Maybe I'll be gone and you'll be sitting in the same spot again another time. I think we'll be here. It's going to be a busy week next week. We're going to have, I don't think reviews will be out of Threadripper or RX Vega by next episode's recording, but we'll have been through the SIGGRAPH show and seen all the releases there. And we'll have a whole bunch more to talk about. We'll probably know all the specifications of RX Vega, which I think we saw some leaks come out today that maybe it's just going to be called RX Vega 64, as in 64 compute units, and RX Vega 56 for 56 compute units. I'm not sure how I feel about those names. They are very descriptive. And on one hand, I appreciate that, so I don't have to ask how many compute units did the RX Vega 1042 BT have. I just know the answer is 64. They should also maybe have like RX Vega 64 TAC clock speeds. So then I know. He's talking about how excited we are to open up all of our new hardware. So that'll be next week. We'll talk about it there. That's a classic video, getting that Nintendo 64. If you are not subscribed yet to This Week in Computer Hardware, you should go to twit.tv/twitch, T-W-I-C-H. You can find all the back episodes. You can find the RSS feeds for our audio version or the video version. There's show notes and kind of links to some of the stuff we talk about throughout in there as well. Do that if you have not done so already. I guess we'll be back next week with another episode. Alan, thanks for filling in.
Yeah, no problem.
Sitting across the table from me.
So far here away.
A little bit.
So far away. Mm-hmm. No, he's got to do the dual camp. There you go. That's better.
Mm-hmm. It's very complicated. All right, everybody. We'll see you guys next week. Thanks.